Any list of history's great scientists will include Sir Isaac Newton. The man invented calculus. He applied the force of gravity to planetary motion. If Isaac Newton had taken the SAT, trust me, he'd have done pretty well. And he believed in God. Newton once said, "He must be blind, mad, and senseless who refuses to acknowledge the Almighty Creator." In his home, Newton had built a replica of the solar system. He sized the planets, and he set their distance to the sun according to scale. Isaac's model also included cranks and cogs and belts so that the planets actually moved in their orbits. One day, an atheistic friend came by. He looked at the model and he said, "My," he said, "who made this brilliant replica?" Newton's reply was abrupt. "Nobody." The scientist laughed. He said, "You didn't hear me. Who built this amazing model?" Newton snapped back, "Nobody." The visitor was finally offended. He said, "Do you think I'm a fool?" And that's when Newton explained, "My solar system is a puny imitation of a grander system. If I can't convince you this toy is without designer and maker, how can you believe the great original came into being without a designer and maker?" What kind of reasoning draws such an absurd conclusion? Indeed. The same logic is as true today as it was in the days of Sir Isaac Newton. How can a universe as complex yet as carefully ordered as our own come into being through chance incidents of accidental circumstances? Notice this glass of water sitting here on the stage. This glass of water sits on the surface of a planet that is spinning on its axis at nearly 1,000 miles per hour. The Earth is orbiting around the sun at 67,000 miles per hour. By the way, that's 30 times faster than a bullet when it leaves the rifle of a gun. You can't tell by the glass of water, but we're speeding through the universe. Don't expect to get frequent flyer credit for this, but over a lifetime, an Earthling will travel a total of about 40 billion miles. You know, our Earth is also part of a solar system that's streaking through the Milky Way galaxy at 560,000 miles per hour. Our galaxy is moving through a galaxy group at 665,000 miles per hour. And our galaxy group is a member of a cluster of galaxies that's moving at a speed of 1,000,000 miles per hour. If you ever get dizzy, now you know why. I hope there are no Snellville cops in the crowd this morning. They'll probably want to write me a speeding ticket. We're moving at a colossal rate of speed, and yet the water in this glass is undisturbed. Not a ripple. Not once have you ever felt like you were flying off the planet. And why? The laws of motion are in exact proportion. You know, today's scientists talk about the fine-tuning of the universe. That nature's forces are precisely designed and balanced to sustain life on our planet. You know, the Earth spins at 1,000 miles per hour. It moves around the sun at 67,000 miles per hour. If we were 2 miles per hour faster or slower, there would be no life on planet Earth. We are finely tuned. Scientist Freeman Dyson quips, "The universe, in some sense, must have known we were coming. It is perfectly prepared for life." Today, our Essentials series tackles God's creation. We'll discuss some debatable details this morning, but let's begin with a statement of essentials that we'll also recite at the end of the message. Here we go. We believe God created all things. Within creation, God established boundaries and distinction. Jesus alone is the sustainer, ruler, and redeemer of His creation. And He created us to worship Him. Now let's begin at the beginning. Genesis chapter 1, verse 1. "Behold the beauty of brevity." The most explosive, far-reaching, mysterious, and majestic moment in history is covered by God in just 10 words. In the beginning, God created the heavens and the earth. Never was so much said in so few words. It's been noted in this one verse. This one verse refutes atheism since the universe was created by God. It refutes pantheism because God is separate from His creation. Polytheism, since one God created all things. Materialism, since matter had a beginning. And humanism, since it was God and not man who is the ultimate reality. You know, Genesis wasn't written as a scientific textbook. It's actually a theological history. Galileo was right when he said, "The Bible isn't as concerned with telling us how the heavens go as it is in telling us how to go to heaven." Nevertheless, the Bible is always consistent with good science. You know, as little as 80 years ago, the prevailing consensus among scientists was that matter and the universe were eternal, that it had no beginning. And this squared nicely with all the world's religions except Judaism and Christianity. Genesis 1:1 tells us that matter is not eternal, that it was created. Today, though, the scientific consensus has flip-flopped. Few scientists today would suggest that the universe is eternal. Instead, astronomers talk about the day of creation. Scientists now believe that the universe is both expanding and slowing down, which means it had to have had a beginning. Today's prevailing hypothesis for the origin of the universe is the Big Bang. It theorizes that about 20 billion years ago, a cloud of hydrogen gas exploded and it spawned the galaxies and the solar systems and the planets. In 1965, two Bell Laboratory scientists, Penzias and Wilson, supposedly proved the Big Bang. They detected a low-level radiation that sort of shrouds and permeates the entire universe. And they interpreted this background radiation as the remnant or the fallout of that first exploding fireball that started it all. There are, though, a few problems with the Big Bang. Often they get overlooked. I mean, why let a few little pesky facts get in the way of a good theory? But first problem, astronomers are cloudy on the origin of the cloud. Where did that first cloud come from? Who passed the initial gas? Second, how did a random explosion yield these sophisticated systems that cover our universe today? A lot of problems. I believe the Big Bang was the initial infusion of energy by the hand of a big God who was beginning His creative work. And this background radiation is the glory of God declared in the heavens that praises Him from day to day. You know, a recent version of the Big Bang called the inflationary Big Bang, it suggests that the universe developed quickly. I mean, within the first few moments that it existed. Secular scientists are moving closer and closer to the biblical account of creation. In his book, God and the Astronomers, former NASA scientist Robert Jastrow, he writes, "It is not a matter of another year, another decade of work, another measurement, or another theory. It seems as though science will never be able to raise the curtain on the mystery of creation. For the scientist who has lived by faith and reason, the story ends like a bad dream. He's scaled the mountains of ignorance. He's about to conquer the highest peak. As he pulls himself over the final rock, he's greeted by a band of theologians who've been sitting there for centuries." You know, a book has an author. A song has a composer. A piece of art has an artist. It's illogical and it's unscientific to expect something greater from something lesser. Behind all complex systems, there has to be a higher intelligence. And what's true in astronomy is also true in biology. You know, with the discovery of the DNA, the old idea of biogenesis, that inanimate matter coupled with energy can produce life, this has become preposterous today. Life requires a third component, not just matter and energy, but information or intelligence. Stick an electrical probe in a jar of peanut butter and all you're going to get is messy peanut butter. Information has to be present for life to form. The late Princeton biologist Edwin Conklin, he wrote this, "The probability of life originating from accident is comparable to the probability of the unabridged dictionary resulting from an explosion in a print shop." take 10 pennies, mark one, then put those 10 pennies in your pocket. If you tried to draw the marked penny, the odds of choosing the right one would be 1 in 10. But if you marked the pennies 1 through 10 and tried to draw the first two pennies in order, the odds would shoot up to 1 in 100. To draw out all 10 in numerical order, the odds would become astronomical, 1 in 10 billion. And that's to simply pull out a string of 10 pennies in sequence. The least complex living cells contain strings of 55 amino acids that link together in just the right order. The odds of the right chemicals emerging by chance from a primordial soup, then connecting in just the right sequence to form a living cell, is beyond reasonable speculation. Two Nobel Prize winners, Fred Hoyle and Chandra Ramasinghe, did research on the probability of life forming at random. They calculated the odds of just 20 amino acids forming by chance as 1 in 10 to the 40,000th power. That's one chance in a number that begins with 1 followed by 40,000 zeros. Of course, evolutionists, they have a lot of faith. They believe that anything can happen given enough time. But even if the Earth is 4.5 billion years old, the odds are still outrageous. The number of seconds in 4.5 billion years is just 10 to the 18th power. So we'd have 10 to the 18th seconds to produce the 10 to the 40,000th chances needed. Fred Hoyle compared the possibility of life evolving at random with the chance of a tornado sweeping through a junkyard and assembling a 747. Molecular biologist Michael Denton calls it simply an affront to reason. Genesis chapter 1, verse 1 states, "In the beginning, God created the heavens and the earth." Notice there's no date. Now, the word translated beginning means an indefinite period. The universe is not like a gallon of milk. It's not stamped with a date. How old is the universe? 20 billion years? 10,000 years. All we have is theories. You know, the only person present at the time was God, and apparently it wasn't that important for him to tell us. All we know is when the curtain opens, there's God, before anything else exists. And it's interesting, but most people suggest either a very old Earth, 4.5 billion years old, or a very young Earth, 6 to 10,000 years old. You know, people who believe in an old Earth, they point to the carbon-14 and the radiometric forms of dating, and they also point to the vast differences between the Earth and the stars. Star distances are measured in light years, or the distance that life travels in the course of a year. The nearest star to our solar system is Proxima Centauri, a mere 4.2 billion light years away. Thus, the Earth is at least 4.2 billion years old. Maybe. That's making some assumptions, though. Is the speed of light consistent everywhere in the universe? Has it slowed down or decayed over time? Did God create the light trails before he created the stars themselves? We don't know these things. There are also some assumptions that we make about radiometric dating, varying decay rates. We make assumptions about the initial deposits in the rocks or the seepage possibilities. Lots of factors can distort results, especially with very old objects. There are also a number of observations that support a young Earth. The Earth's decaying magnetic field. The mineral content of the ocean, the appearance of short-term comets, the absence of dust on the surface of the moon. Young Earth scientists, and trust me, there are many more than you think. They believe that the global deluge of Noah's day compressed the Earth's topography. I believe that a worldwide flood offers a far better explanation for the fossil record than just normal decomposition and uniform processes over long ages. Young Earth advocates will also talk about the appearance of age. When God created Adam, he was one day old. But did he look like he was one day old? No, he had the stature and the appearance of a grown man. Remember, Adam was the perfect physical specimen. I figure he had the body of a 51-year-old. Adam was created with maturity. And if that's how God created Adam, why shouldn't all his creation have an appearance of age? Did the trees in the Garden of Eden have annual rings? Did God create eggs with yolks? Did Adam have a belly button? These are all interesting questions. There's another way to look at the age of the earth. The planet may be very old, but life may be very young. Everyone agrees that Homo sapiens, or man, appeared just 6,000 to 10,000 years ago. Verse 1 here in Genesis reads, "In the beginning, God created." The Hebrew word translated created is bara, which means to create out of nothing. Here is the first cause. Here is the prime mover. God begins with no raw materials, no building blocks, yet he fashions the universe with nothing but the power of his word. There's another Hebrew word that often gets translated create. It's the word asah. And when you hear it, think of a similar sounding word, assemble. If we borrowed this stool, it would appear out of nothing, out of thin air. But if we were to asah this stool, we would go down to Lowe's and we would buy a few dowel rods and some nails and some varnish. And then we'd come back and we'd assemble it or put it all together. Now here's where the plot thickens. In Exodus chapter 31, verse 17, Moses tells us, "In 6 days the Lord made," or asod, "the heavens and the earth. And on the seventh day he rested." Now Moses wrote both Genesis and Exodus. In Genesis, the universe was created from nada. In Exodus, it was assembled from existing materials. Which is it? It could be both. Notice verse 2 here in Genesis. "The earth was without form and void, and darkness was on the face of the deep." This scene is not what we would expect. In chapter 1 of Genesis, each aspect of God's creation is followed by his pronouncement, "It is good." But here the earth is not good. It's unformed and it's unfilled. The Hebrew phrase is tohu wabohu. This terminology usually describes the aftermath of some judgment, some cataclysmic event. Verse 2 depicts the earth as shapeless and chaotic, a vast sea shrouded in darkness, which reminds me of a joke. Three professionals, a doctor, an engineer, and a politician, they're all arguing over whose profession happens to be the oldest. Well, the doctor noted that God performed surgery on Adam when he created Eve. The medical profession has to be older. The engineer pointed to creation. In just 6 days, God started with chaos and confusion. And from that, he constructed the universe. Engineering has to be the older discipline. That's when the politician jumped in. He kind of cleared his throat and he said, "Where do you think the chaos and confusion came from?" Isaiah chapter 45, verse 18 shines a light on verse 2. It says that God did not create the earth in vain. Rather, he formed it to be inhabited. Planet Earth was not created in vain, or tohu, that same word used in Genesis 1, verse 2. Genesis says the earth was created tohu, or unformed. Isaiah says, no, it was created formed and inhabitable. So which is it? Again, perhaps it's both. I believe that a gap of time exists between Genesis 1, verse 1 and Genesis 1, verse 2. When did God create the angels? Well, Genesis doesn't tell us. But Job 38, verse 7 tells us that they shouted for joy when God laid the foundations of the earth. We know one of the angels sinned. Isaiah 14 and Revelation 12 depict Lucifer's fall and how a third of the angels join him in his revolt. Jesus, in fact, said in Luke 10, verse 18, "I saw Satan fall like lightning from heaven." It's possible that Lucifer's fall brought on a horrible judgment that damaged God's initial creation. In verse 1 of Genesis, God creates a beautiful world that's then scarred and defaced by Satan's revolt. In verse 2, he begins again, reforming and refilling that world. But a long gap of time may have elapsed between the two verses. What's important is that you believe God created the heavens and the earth. The rest of Genesis 1 depicts six creative days, which of course prompts another question. Are these 6 days literal 24-hour periods, or are they longer ages? The Hebrew word for day is yom. It appears 1,424 times in the Old Testament, and it gets translated 51 different ways. Based on the term alone, you can't be dogmatic. But if you take these days as geological ages of millions of years, you've got a lot of problems. For example, plants are created on day 3 that require the pollination of insects that don't appear until day 5. If these days were millions of years apart, the plants would have never survived. To make a long story short, I believe the language of Genesis suggests that these days were indeed 6 24-hour periods. The phrase, the evening and the morning, I think supports that idea. In the rest of Genesis 1, God prepares the planet. He decks it out and He paves the way for the crown of His creation, the man and the woman. On day 1, God separates light from darkness. On day 2, He divides the waters above from the waters below. Water is suspended as vapor in the clouds. God creates the hydrological system. On day 3, God draws out the land and He divides the sea and gives it boundaries. He then generates life on the planet, plant life, grasses and herbs and berries and fruit trees. On day 4, God further divides day from night and separates seasons. On day 5 and 6, God separates animals by their natural habitats. He fills the sky with birds, the sea with fish, and He puts creepy crawlers on the earth, insects and amphibians and reptiles and mammals. And 10 times we're told God created everything, quote, according to its kind. Understand the difference between micro and macro evolution. Microevolution recognizes the adaptability that's been programmed into our DNA. Mutations do occur in living organisms. Birds that migrate to new environments can change color to blend into their new surroundings. Though a bird may adapt, it remains a bird, though. It's created after its kind. In 1859, Charles Darwin wrote The Origin of the Species. That's what they told you it was called. But I want you to listen to its true title. It was actually called The Origin of Species by Means of Natural Selection or the Preservation of Favored Races in the Struggle for Life. Catch a little racist overtone there? Darwin believed that just as certain animals were superior to other species and the stronger would eventually destroy the lesser, likewise certain races were superior and were destined to out-evolve inferior races. Darwin believed that Caucasians had out-evolved blacks and that Australians had out-evolved Aborigines. You see, proponents of evolution, they don't want you to know about this racist element involved. Darwin also promoted macroevolution. A fish crawls out on the ground and ends up a bird. An ape climbs down out of the tree and becomes a human. Macroevolution doesn't just involve mutations, but transmutations. You see, this is the great failure of evolution. With all the fossils found all over the world, there's a glaring absence of these transitional forms. In other words, the missing link is still missing. You know, when Kathy gave birth, we were pretty sure that we'd have a boy or a girl. Not an ape or a walnut. Granted, at times they act like monkeys and they get a little nutty, but they're Adamses. And they will reproduce Adamses. And we hope soon. The two that are married, at least. Thankfully, all 4 of my kids mutated and turned out far better looking than their father. Microevolution and genetic adaptation is a marvel, but macroevolution is a myth. God created all things according to its kind. A key theme in Genesis is God's establishment of boundaries within His creation. You see, the Creator Himself remains separate and distinct from His creation. He distinguishes light from darkness, day from night. He then divides waters above from waters below. He separates the sea from the land. He draws specific habitats. He engineers life to produce after its kind. God even creates humanity with distinction, male and female. And remember why this matters. And we talked on week one about the two current worldviews. Paganism is one-ism. Christianity is two-ism. One-ism denies any distinctions amongst creation. There's one circle, the circle of life. And one-ism tries to push and keep everything within that one circle. Recently, the Dalai Lama stated, "The world used to believe there are two. We now know there is one." And very few people grasp his deception. You see, one-ism denies the distinction between God and his creation. In one-ism, God is in all, and all is in God. You don't look for God outside the circle. You look within. You look for the spark within you, the God within you. And this is just the tip of the iceberg. In one-ism, the entire spirit world is forced into the circle. There's no distinction between angels and demons, between good forces and bad forces. People just talk about spirits. Neither does one-ism distinguish between plants and animals. A city tries to chop down an old oak tree for a new park, and the tree huggers come to protest. And why? One-ism teaches that the tree has the same rights as the dogs and the humans that'll play in the park. All is one. All is within the one circle. This is the worldview of the radical animal rights groups. One PETA spokesperson drew this connection. She said this, "A rat is a pig, is a dog, is a boy." You see, if there's no distinction between humans and animals, if humans are just highly evolved animals, then a man has no more rights than a rat. Feminism breaks down the distinctions between male and female. Gender doesn't matter in one-ism. When everything is inside the circle, society has no choice but to accept homosexuality and lesbianism and prostitution and cohabitation and any other form of sexuality. Who's to say one arrangement is any better than another? This is why same-sex marriage is the sacrament and the celebration of one-ism. It glorifies oneness. Homosexual marriage totally erases the boundaries and the distinctions that God weaved into the fabric of our civilization. In one-ism, all moral distinctions disappear. Since all is one, right and wrong don't exist. There is no true or false. There's no authority, only voices. Mass murderer Charles Manson was recently quoted as saying, "If all is one, what is bad? If everything is in the same circle, why is racism evil and kindness good?" It's tragic, but today, one-ism has even invaded the church. So-called emergent churches see themselves as inside the one circle. Rather than trumpet God's truth, rather than stand on the Bible's authority, their goal is to draw other people in the circle into a conversation. Rather than say that we made a wrong turn, they talk about us all being on the same journey. Ultimately, one-ism downplays religious differences and promotes a common faith. Everyone can worship his own higher power. It doesn't matter how you define him or her or it, as long as you're tolerant. And this is why Jesus is the enemy of one-ism. Jesus doesn't try to be politically correct. Jesus isn't afraid of being exclusive. He acknowledges distinction and difference. We're not one, we're two. Creation is in the circle, but God is outside the circle, calling us to turn from our sin. Jesus says to postmodern ears, "I am the way, the truth, and the life. No one comes to the Father except through me." Jesus alone can save us. You see, our hope is two-ism, not one-ism. The Creator is not a part of His creation. He exists outside the circle to sustain us. and to rule over us and to redeem us. Colossians 1, verse 16 and 17 says of Jesus, by Him all things were created. He's our Creator. In heaven and in earth, all things were created through Him and for Him. And He is before all things, and in Him all things hold together. As Creator, Jesus sustains and He rules and He redeems His creation. Collins' law observes that like charges repel. Yet every atom's nucleus consists of similarly charged particles, or protons. What keeps atomic structure intact? Colossians says that Jesus holds all things together. Jesus is the atomic glue. He sustains what He creates. You know, the Bible records how the universe began, but it also records how it will end. 2 Peter 3 verse 10 reads, the elements will melt with fervent heat. One day, Jesus will let go His grip, and it'll all go up in a blaze of glory. In the meantime, it is Jesus who holds it all together and sustains our very lives, not just atomically, but He holds together our marriages and our families and our friendships and our sanity and our church. You see, from outside the circle, Jesus sustains and He rules over the circle. Jesus is the ruling party today. He defines right from wrong. Colossians says He is before all things. One day, all creation will be judged by Jesus. That includes you. Please don't miss the obvious this morning. If Jesus created life, He knows the best way for us to live. The fool ignores His wisdom. You see, it makes sense for us to trust our Creator. And Jesus also redeems. Colossians says that we were created for Him. Here's the good news this morning. Your life is not an accident. You are not just a whim of nature. God knew you and He loved you before you were ever born. You know, next week we're going to learn that we've been scarred by sin. But Jesus isn't scared off by damaged property. He came to earth and He came to the cross to buy back what belongs to Him. Oneism is fatalistic. If all is one, we have no real choices. But in twoism, we can choose to worship the creation or we can worship the Creator. You see, every human being is a worshiper at heart. Worship is in our spiritual DNA. God put it in our hearts. Over the ages, men have worshipped nature, or they worship the sun or the stars, or they've made gods from animals, or they've worshipped the human body, or sex, or money, or pleasure, or themselves. But everyone worships. Philosopher Mortimer Adler didn't become a Christian until he was 81 years old. And when asked why it took him so long to come to a decision, he answered, I simply didn't want to exercise a will to believe. In other words, he wasn't waiting on more facts to come in. I mean, the truth was obvious long before he made his decision. The issue was not could he believe, but would he believe? Atheism is a convenient excuse not to bow. Not to bow your knee. Don't be stubborn and reject the truth of God just because you want to have it your way. Well, let's conclude by reciting this morning's statement of faith. We're going to do this kind of like when you got married. You remember how that happened? Pastor said something and then you repeated it. This is how we're going to do this morning. You ready? I'm going to say it and then I want you to repeat what I say. Here we go. We believe God created all things. Within creation, God established boundaries and distinction. Jesus alone is the sustainer, ruler, and redeemer of His creation. And He created us to worship Him. Thank You for this, Lord. Thank You for these truths. Thank You that You are our Creator. And since You created us, Lord, You know best how we should live our lives. Help us not be foolish. Help us not be stubborn. Help us not refuse to bow our knee to you. But Lord, help us to embrace you as Lord of the circle, as the creator of life. And help us to begin to live our lives your way. We ask it in Jesus' name. And all God's people said, amen. Let's continue to worship the Lord.
During the next couple songs, I'd like to invite you guys to feel free to just come forward and